Blog Talk Radio.
Your host, Merle Exit. Okay, let's see, it's 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm in New York City. It's partly cloudy or partly sunny, depend on how. Well, they don't say partly sunny. They always tell you partly cloudy. The weather people, what can you do? I always say it was partly sunny today. I got a heck of a show. Yeah, we're going to go to Providence, Rhode Island to talk about food, my favorite subject. And by the way, I'm getting some food delivered today from Providence, from one of the companies up there, from, wait a second, it's Vendor Ravioli is sending me some ravioli. So I don't know what time it's going to be delivered. But it might be delivered in the middle of the show, at which point I will just take the telephone and we will walk over to the door and say hello to the UPS guy. Anyway, but yes, a word from my sponsor first. And then, first let me tell you what we're doing. First, we're going to have Chef Steve Long is going to tell us about local fish and the restaurant that he works with. That's called Hemingway's, as opposed to Hemingway's. It's Hemingway's. And then we have Dave Lenning of Dave's Coffee is going to tell us about this thing called coffee syrup. Apparently, there's this whole thing with coffee milk in Rhode Island. And then I'm going to have Richard Gutman, who's a curator of the Culinary Arts Museum, to talk with us and to tell us what does it house in there. But now is the word from our sponsor, and of course, it's food. What else?
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies, and that's no fairy tale.
Oh, yes, and you can get these wonderful brownies at www.brownies.com. Yes, I can. Grater's Ice Cream just came out with this black cherry chip ice cream. I'm just thinking about that and putting that on top of a brownie. Oh, my God. Anyway, let's get away from the sugar and let's get to talking about some local seafood instead. Hey, hello, Steve.
Hi, Merle. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Get away from talking about dessert. Let's talk about, savory.
Oh, I don't blame you. That blackberry, chocolate chip ice cream sounds great.
Oh, God. If you ever get a chance, you got it. Grater's Ice Cream. I don't know if they're selling it up there. Anyway, but getting away from that, let's get into people don't necessarily, when people think of local fish, they always think of maybe you're actually on the shore, Maine or Massachusetts. What I understand is a lot of local fish in coming from Rhode Island. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. There is some great local fish that comes out of Rhode Island. This time of year, it gets a little tougher to get all local fish. So, you know, obviously we're buying some fish from all over the place. But one of the nice year-round things that comes out of Rhode Island are great calamari. The great local squid comes right out of Point Judith. That is the largest port that produces squid in the United States. So we get fantastic calamari out of there, which we do Rhode Island style here, of course. And we also do it a different way as well. We do a kung pao with that, which is like a pineapple sweet chili sauce that we do with that great local Point Judith squid.
Wow. By the way, do you notice that we always call it calamari? And no one, it's like for years I thought, you know, I'm having calamari. And someone says, what is it? You know, calamari. I didn't know
right.
It was squid.
It's a great thing. I love it. It's
when
it's
made
one
correctly.
Of those things that's made. Yeah, one of those things that we get right from right close by. Another great thing that we do here that mostly local is our oysters. Rhode Island produces some fantastic oysters, as well as the neighboring regions, as well as you know, Connecticut and up in Massachusetts. We have some wonderful oysters with some really great varieties. So one of the oysters that we have here at Hemingway's almost every day is a walrus and carpenter oyster, which is produced down in Nitigrit Pond, which produces quite a few other oysters as well. But this is an oyster that we buy directly from the farmer, so which is great. You know, there's no middleman. The farmer does everything. He raises the oyster, he harvests them, and he delivers them. He does the whole thing. And we actually deal with a couple different oyster farmers in that way, which is great. You know, we get it directly from the farm, which is a wonderful way of doing things. But that walrus and carpenter is named from Alice in Wonderland. So that was a popular maybe not the most well-known part of Alice in Wonderland, but it was a part where Walrus and Carpenter tricked the oysters into being their friends, and then they ate them.
Wow.
So that's where that name comes from. There's some silly named oysters out there, and that's definitely probably one of the ones, but it's an excellent oyster. It's a very nice.
Now, let me ask you, with these oyster farms that are there, can people go there and then get a tour?
I don't know if the gentleman's name is Jules Upton Himmel.
Mm-hmm.
He runs the Walrus and Carpenter Oysters. I know he's offered to give me a tour, which I'm going to take advantage of here this spring or summer.
Mm-hmm.
I'll stay away from there right now. It's a little too chilly to be going out on the oyster farm for me. I'll leave that to him.
Yeah.
But I know he's offered it for myself. I don't know if it's something that he does to the public, but I believe Jules has, you know, you could find him online and perhaps find out if that's something that he would offer.
Right. So you're saying there's more than the only oyster farm I've been to was one in on the Cape in Venice.
Right.
That's why I was kind of curious. I didn't know how many, like, oyster farms there are versus, I mean, I guess they're not all farms, right? I mean, when you're dealing with oysters, there could be just people going out and, you know, do they get them? I don't know how they catch them. I mean,
there are some wild oysters.
Okay.
The majority of the oysters that we sell here and the majority of oysters that are sold and, you know, consumed at restaurants are farm-raised oysters. But one of the local ones that we do get here that is a wild is actually called Rhode Island Wild. So that is an oyster that is harvested. So they do that by you know, they basically use a dredging technique that will pull those up from the bottom of the ocean, similar to how scallops are harvested, wild scallops.
So, do you see any advantage or disadvantage of whether they're, you know, a farm or dredged up?
There's definitely some differences. The big difference between a farm raised and a wild oyster is the shell. A wild oyster that is basically an oyster will attach itself to anything that it can, and then it'll grow on that, on whatever it's attached to, and it'll take on the opposite shape of whatever it's attached to. So with the wild oysters, oftentimes you'll find a lot of irregular cup sizes, you know, where you'll have an oyster that is kind of like, instead of having a nice cup that'll hold the liquor of the oyster,
yeah.
It'll have like a big bow in the middle of it, so it won't hold that nice liquor. So, you know, that's the one thing where I would say farm raised oysters are better, but
how about taste wise?
Taste wise, there's every oyster has slightly different flavor profiles. So from one oyster to the next, you're always going to find, you know, one that's a little sweeter, you know, some that are more briny, you know, some that have like a high minerality to them, like the blue points. The blue points have quite a minerality to them. So, you know, so you're going to have taste variations between every oyster anyway. So wild oysters aren't different in that way. They're going to have a different variation. But those Rhode Island wilds, the ones that I mentioned, are really nice. And there's another one up in Prince Edward Island area that
mm-hmm.
they harvest wild as well. And those are nice. And
was that the one that I got? There was one I got that was out of Canada. Was that the one I got? And it was like,
no, actually, you
weird shaped.
Right. Yeah. No, those actually were a Beausoleil oyster. That,
okay.
That is out of Nova Scotia, like you said, and you know, those are a nice. Those are smaller oysters. It's more of a cocktail grade oyster.
Uh-huh.
But those are really nice. They have a nice sweet flavor to them. And they actually will grow those oysters a little larger, and they sell them under a little different name, which we used around Valentine's Day. They were the French Kiss oysters.
Oh, okay.
So Beausoleils, when they let them grow another year or so, they become French Kisses.
All right, let's get into the other seafood, and I guess when I call this seafood, I break seafood into two groups, and I call it the kosher and the non-kosher. That's
okay.
The best way, if you know what I mean, right?
Sure, I understand.
Yeah, and it's
we do a lot of both, so.
So it's like what you're talking, because people don't, you know, when you talk about kosher, it just means that they're not the fish that swim on the bottom of the ocean or that kind of a thing. That
right,
they're,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And usually you're talking about shellfish.
Right,
when you say
exactly.
You're non-kosher fish. So,
exactly.
Which you seem to specialize in is a lot of shellfish. Is that correct?
We do.
Restaurant?
We do quite a bit. I'd say, lobster being probably... and I know that's in the non-kosher category.
Yeah.
That's probably the thing that we sell the most of. We sell it in quite a few different applications. I know you really enjoyed our crab and lobster burger that we have on our lunch menu.
That was
good. We obviously use it in that application. We have we do lobster bisque. We do. A lobster mac and cheese on our dinner menu. We do a great lobster salad that we serve on greens or on a toasted bulky roll with bacon, lettuce, and tomato. We call it a lobster BLT. We also do it. We have a tank here in the restaurant, which is nice. So we're able to keep.
Where is it located?
It's right next to our raw bar.
Okay,
It's a beautiful tank that cascades down. So we keep 1 1/4 pounds, and then from 2 all the way up to, usually 5, and sometimes we'll bring in larger lobsters upon request. We've had 7-8 pound lobsters in here that we've brought in for guests that asked for that.
Wow. Do you ever get calls just to use, because it's got the, you're not showing them, you're using them for the meat?
Absolutely. Yep. We buy. We bring in about 50 pounds of culls a day. We cook those off, and then we use that meat in all the applications that we use lobster meat in, which is somewhat not readily done. Most places that are using lobster meat will buy frozen lobster meat and go that route, which is a lot easier on labor and a lot easier. Just a lot more efficient, but we feel that the fresh lobster meat is really the way to go. And
I visited a place in Portland, Maine, where they shuck the lobster, and what you would be getting as a chef, or I guess at somebody's house, is you're getting the raw meat in the shell.
Oh, the raw meat?
Yes. So what you're getting is the raw meat in the shell. So you're not getting it frozen. You're getting it fresh, but it's already
shucked. It's not alive?
So you can use it to cook fresh.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. But anyway, not many places know that. I thought that was second best to having it. To having it fresh. One of the things is when it comes to lobster, I never go to a place and have lobster tails. Either give me the whole lobster fresh, or don't give me the tail. It's frozen. You're re-cooking. It's already
almost,
cooked.
Yeah, almost. I'd say you're 99% right. Yeah, very rarely would you find a fresh lobster tail. Yeah, and a lot of times what they use when they say they're selling lobster tail is a South American lobster or an Australian lobster, like the spiny lobster,
right?
Which is fine. I mean, it has its place, especially if you're in the Caribbean or if you're in Australia or on the West Coast, and that's what's fresh and that's what it's available to you. I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
But here, I mean, we got lobsters swimming around, mile from the restaurant. So we'll use what we got local.
Yeah. What about in terms of the crab meat, by the way? Is that
Maryland? We use a couple different kinds of crab meat. The meat in the crab and lobster burger and the crab and lobster cakes that we have, we use a Jonah crab, which is a locally caught crab as well. It's actually a bycatch of the lobsterman.
I've been at the – I've seen lobster traps.
Right.
Yeah, and that what comes out the Jonah crabs.
Exactly.
That's a good idea. Yeah, the Jonah crab you got, and it's kind of like you have to kind of distinguish that between that and the ones that are on the West Coast, which is not the same.
Right.
Which is the what's the crabs?
Well, Alaskan king crab legs are. Or
oh, I don't mean the
Alaskan
the ones that you get like in San Francisco.
Oh, those are, I believe those are blue crabs, I think.
No, they're very large. They're large. I'll think of it. But, anyway, so let's get into some of the other, the other seafood basically, how about scallops? Are you getting them also?
Absolutely, yeah, that was definitely one of the things that I wanted to mention. Scallops is probably the second most thing that we sell here. We use them in quite a few different applications as well. We do a shrimp and scallop ceviche, that we have on our appetizer menu. We do bacon wrap scallops, which is, I mean, how could you resist one of those? And we do them grilled, we do them baked. We have a dish on our menu right now with pumpkin raviolis that we serve with the scallops, and we do a little bit of pancetta and a brown butter sauce, and we use some locally produced pea greens, which actually I think I brought you some pea greens when you were at the restaurant.
Yes. They're very expensive when you buy them.
They can be, yeah. We buy them directly from a farmer as well.
Okay.
We buy those from a farm. It's actually called Farming Turtles down in, I believe it's in North Kingstown, which is southern Rhode Island. And she grows those as well as a bunch of other things. She does mushrooms. She does all kinds of different microgreens. We buy some microgreens from her as well that we garnish most of our plates with. So, but yeah, the scallops we get from New Bedford is the largest sea scallop port in the world as well. So,
I think I did a press trip there. Yes, and I remember how good they were.
Yeah, so scallops. New Bedford is Massachusetts. We're obviously Rhode Island, but you know, there's parts of Massachusetts that are closer to us than parts of Rhode Island are. You know, so to me, Massachusetts is just as local as anything that's coming out of Rhode Island. So
when somebody's getting scallops, how do they know? Because I heard that, like, you know, the substitutes that they...
There's not as much substituting going on as there once was. That was something that was done years ago. They used to punch out skate wing. Was one of the things that I heard that was done. I've never seen it. I think those things were done years before I was working in the industry.
Skate wing. You ever make skate wing?
We have. I really enjoy it, actually. It's you know, a lot of people kind of look at it as a garbage fish or a bait fish. But when it's exceptionally fresh, it is outstanding. The only tricky part with that is if it is not exceptionally fresh, then it degrades. The quality of it really goes down fast. So that's the tricky part with it. You know, when you get it, you know, we'll get it in as a special, and we want to run that. We want to sell that special out the first night that we run it.
Do you take it like totally off the cartilage, or
we do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
We remove it from the skin and the cartilage, and then once you get it like that, it really performs a lot like a flatfish, like a sole or a flounder. So we've done it Frenchaise style, you know, where we egg and flour, batter it, and then saute it with lemon and white wine and capers, and finish it with butter, and that's a really nice way to eat it. And then we've stuffed it. You really can do anything with it that you would any other flatfish.
What would you say it's a cross between, if they're trying to tell people?
Well, it's in the shark family, but it doesn't really, it doesn't have a flavor, anything like shark. So, you know, a mild, I wouldn't say quite fluke, but maybe like a flounder, something in that.
Right, but the texture what would you say?
Yeah, the texture is definitely a little different. Maybe the texture would mimic a little bit closer, you know, like kind of a cross between monkfish and a flatfish. So it's not as tough as a monkfish, but it's definitely tougher,
right,
or not. It's a firmer texture than your flounders or soles.
Yeah.
So, but it's not something currently that we have on our, you know, we don't usually menu it, but it's something that we will use from time to time.
Now, you're in the downtown area, right?
We are.
Okay.
Yep, we're right across the street from the courthouse, and we are at 121 South Main Street in Providence.
And so, in terms of the other fish that you get, when you're getting the fish, as opposed to the shellfish.
Right.
Are you getting that local as well? I don't know what you have. I mean, you know, here in New York, you go to, I guess, there's a fish market, you know. Do you have the same kind of a thing, or you have, getting them off the boat?
Well, yeah, there's several fish auctions in this area that fresh fish is landed at every day. So New Bedford being one of them, Boston, and then up further north, there's one in Maine as well. So there's always fresh fish coming in to all those ports. And then, but you know, this time of year, it's a little tougher. I mean, being the kind of restaurant that we are, we always have swordfish on our menu. We always have tuna. Mahi-mahi is one of the fish that we most of the time have on our menu. And those fish roam all the oceans, you know, so they are nowhere near here this time of year. But in the summertime, those are being caught right in our waters and you know, both north and south and of here. So that's, you know, those are locally caught, but not this time of year.
Right. Now, when you're making tuna tartare, you have to use a certain grade, don't you?
We use a sushi grade, yes, so that we, so that it can be consumed raw.
Yeah, because you can't just go to the store and say, I think I'll buy some fresh tuna and eat it raw.
Well, I mean, it depends on, you know, really what it comes down to is trusting who you're buying it from. You know, that's what has made us successful over the years is that we hold our vendors to a very high standard and we make sure that we're only using the best vendors so that we can trust what we're getting in. So the quality of the fish that we're serving here is the best. You know, so. And that's what you know as a consumer you need to have that trust of the place that you're buying fish. You know, if you don't think the fish market that you're buying your fish from is of a high quality, then you really shouldn't buy your fish from there. You should make sure that you find it from a place that is second to none quality, and you have to pay for it. That's the unfortunate thing. You know, there's no such thing as good quality cheap fish anymore.
Now, let me ask you, in terms of like signature dishes, have you had the opportunity, like you'll come up with something, you'll experiment and say, this tastes great, let's put this on the menu? Is that something that
absolutely
you do?
Yep. That's how we develop our menu. We do you know, we run things as specials. We tweak. You know, we let people try it. We have discussions about it, and then that's how things make their way onto the menu. You know, so we have a process that we follow so that we can do that. One of the dishes that we're doing right now that I really love is we do a pistachio roasted garlic. Crusted mahi-mahi that we serve with an autumn or a root vegetable hash.
Wait a minute. That's what came out. That root vegetable hash.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes.
So
tell us about that. What that was.
So that's one of the nice things, you know, this time of year, to be able to use local ingredients. You know, the root vegetables are, you know, they store well, so you know, we're able to use, you know, local sweet potatoes, parsnips, butternut squash, you know, turnips, so all those root vegetables which we roast, and then we make a hash out of that with some onions, and then we crisp it up nicely with some butter so that everything's
and the pancetta, right?
Yeah, and yeah. When I um, when I brought you a little chef's course when you came, and I added some pancetta to it for that for when I brought it out for you. But actually, for the dish on the menu, we don't add the pancetta to that.
Oh, okay.
But for the dish on the menu, we actually do a cranberry. We do a cranberry relish, which again, those are locally produced in Carver, Mass.
Right.
And then we do that with some rocket greens, some native apple, and we finish that with a maple chili gastrique, which we do with maple syrup and sherry vinegar and some poblano peppers and shallots, which we all reduce down, which makes a nice finishing sauce for that dish.
I forgot. What was the fish that I had with it?
I think I brought you a scallop.
Oh, okay. Right. Yes, okay. You know what happened? My camera wasn't ready, and I'm going, oh, my God, because that's how I remember everything, is I take pictures, and I'm looking, you know, at the photos, and I'm trying to write, and I'm going, what did I have? And I totally forgot about, and I got to put that in the blog. I didn't get up to the articles yet. I have to get that into the blog. So I, you know, so I want to make sure I put that in about the, well, I don't know whether they call that, we call that an amuse bouche.
Sure, sure. You can call it that. We call it a chef's course, but
okay.
But same thing. Amuse, amuse bouche.
Yeah.
So yeah, just a little something to welcome you to the restaurant and and to make you feel special. So.
That certainly whet my appetite. I have to tell you.
Good.
That was really, really tasty. I have to say, that was one of the best amuse bouches I've ever come across.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Just all the flavors and
I'm sure you've had
a few. And everything that you did, it was wow, you know, like that my brain was going, is this the main course, maybe, perhaps?
Right. Right, I'll have a larger version of that, please.
Yes, right. So, well, I appreciate you calling in. I'll be back there.
I hope so.
Yeah, I'm coming back, I think, at the end of June, because I want to get some of the places that I didn't get to in Providence, as well as explore maybe the rest of Rhode Island other than, like, the Newport area.
Oh, good. Yeah, we have a few restaurants within the group, so we're part of Newport Restaurant Group, which is we have a place in Tiverton called the Boathouse, which is another part of Rhode Island, and then down in Narragansett, we have a restaurant called Trio, and then in Newport we have quite a few spots as well. Castle Hill, we have the Mooring, and 22 Bowens, which and then also the Smokehouse, which is something that's a little different from most of our restaurants, is down there in Newport as well, which is a barbecue place, which is awesome. That's one of my favorite things. So I really enjoy the Smokehouse.
Great. Okay. Well, we're going to go on next to talking about coffee milk. I have really had some fun, I have to tell you, in using coffee syrup and baking things.
Yeah, that's definitely a Rhode Island thing.
Yeah, so I got Dave waiting for us. Oh, wait, maybe Dave wants to. Dave can say hello to you. Wait, Dave, you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Merle.
Yeah, you can say hello to Chef Steve.
Hi, Chef. How are you doing?
Good, Dave. How are you?
Excellent. Have you heard of our coffee syrup?
Love a good glass of coffee milk.
Yeah. Have you heard of our syrup before?
What's the name of it?
It's Dave's Coffee Syrup.
I think I have seen it. Yeah, now that you mention it, I love a good glass of coffee milk.
Yeah, we're pretty new, but we got an amazing, like, just all natural coffee syrup.
That's great.
You may want to have fun experimenting with that. I don't
Maybe.
Know how you could do with seafood, but who knows? I've been. Okay, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Meryl.
Okay, have a great evening.
Okay, look forward to seeing you in the summertime.
And enjoy dinner for me.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
So, well, that stuff, that's coffee syrup. I've experimented. Well, first, before I get into what I've done.
Okay.
Let's tell my audience what the hell this is and what it's all about, this craze.
Yeah, well, coffee syrup it started in the 1930s. And it was introduced in this area in Rhode Island by a pharmacy that had a soda count there and wanted to do something different to keep new customers, to attract new customers, and they came up with coffee syrup. So that's how it began back in the 30s. And it's somehow stayed in Rhode Island and for some reason didn't, like, go past the boundaries of the state. But as you know, like I was telling you, that we came up with a kind of like an updated version of it where it's an all-natural syrup. So it doesn't contain all of the corn syrup and the high-fructose sweeteners and fake colors and preservatives that a lot of the syrups do.
Okay, since I've never heard of it, so I've never mm-hmm. had it before. So in other words, there are coffee syrups. And basically, when you're seeing them, it's not the same. Like what I'm getting about your coffee syrup is it's basically made out of coffee, sugar,
right.
water. That's it.
Yep, two ingredients. It's just we cold brew a Brazilian coffee.
Right.
So instead of hot brewing it sits in a big steel kettle for 18 hours. And what that does is it extracts the body of the coffee, but not as much of the acidity. So it just results in a really nice, smooth, like, coffee, and it's more concentrated. And then we take that and then reduce it down with just pure cane sugar. And that combination of ingredients boils for a little over 2 hours into that thick syrup that we get at the end.
Wow.
So
it's
yeah,
not like somebody can do this at home.
I mean, you could if you have a lot of patience, a lot of time, but it definitely, I don't think, would come out as good just because we actually sourced a specific coffee that the flavor profile of it was unique, and we got it specifically for our syrup. And it's a Brazilian coffee. It's got a really nice, nutty, sweet, smooth flavor to it, and it just, like, is perfect for the syrup.
So if you were to do... Have people, like, experimented with different coffees, and would it taste different, like, if you did different coffees to make the syrup?
It would taste different. When we, you know, we it's been on the market for just about a year, but we took about 6 months experimenting with just that. We tried different coffees. We tried different roast levels on the coffees to see which would result in a better-tasting syrup. And at the end, we came down to this Brazilian coffee that was just perfect. So, because it's got to be a good balance, you know, between the coffee flavor and the sweetness of the sugar. And it's kind of like that balance where you don't want one overpowering the other.
Right.
So that's what it came down to.
Now, just like one of the things, I mean, I haven't done this yet, is can you just, like, if you took it and let's just say you boiled some water, and poured the coffee syrup in the water and added milk. Is that like reconstituting it and getting a hot cup of coffee or no?
I do that except minus the water. Like I'll heat up a glass of milk and put coffee syrup in it. I think because the syrup is sweet, like it's better to add it just to milk or over other things and not add the water because that kind of just dilutes it.
Oh, okay. So in other words, if somebody says, I feel like having a hot cup of coffee, but I don't put any milk in it, that's
right.
Not something you would want to do.
No.
Okay.
But another good thing it is good for, though, is like at our coffee bar in Rhode Island, we leave a bottle out on the counter for when people buy iced coffees and they add a little shot of coffee syrup in it because it sweetens it. It dissolves instantly because it's a liquid. And then it also adds a little more coffee kick to it.
So it's like getting an extra shot of espresso kind of thing.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. I'll have to try that one.
Yeah.
Wow. So, okay, so another word, I understand there was like when kids went to school, they'd have that choice?
Yeah, like here in Rhode Island, all the schools still serve coffee milk. They have little cartons of coffee milk.
So, but they don't consider it, do they do it like decaffeinated coffee milk or?
Nope, they don't. But you know, the amount of caffeine that's in it is really small because of just the volume. Like in an 8-ounce glass of coffee milk, I'll put a couple of tablespoons. So it's just a tiny bit of syrup and then a lot of milk. So it's not
right.
really an issue with the caffeine content.
What would you say? I don't know if you've ever looked at it. Does it have, let's say, more caffeine than if you put chocolate syrup?
You know, I've never compared it to chocolate syrup.
Okay.
I'm just
kind of curious because people
yeah.
constantly, you know, chocolate milk's a big thing, and they
right.
always think of, like, kids shouldn't have coffee.
Yeah, right, right.
But, you know, like, how much does, in terms of, I mean, my brain is thinking, like, I hate Hershey syrup, but, you know, the idea of putting Hershey syrup in milk, and it's like, you know, well, you know, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I like you getting real chocolate, you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, yep.
Okay. So let me tell you what I've done. So I haven't gone out to get milk yet. I've been playing.
Uh-huh.
I've been playing with this stuff.
Yeah.
I got to tell you what I did. I had some ground bison in the house.
Uh huh.
And I decided going to make some meatballs. I made some meatballs, and with the sauce, I took a can of like crushed tomatoes, and I cooked that in there and added some of the coffee syrup.
Uh-huh.
Tasted great.
Yeah, yeah. I bet it did. You know, we do a pulled pork with a coffee syrup barbecue glaze on it, which is delicious.
Oh, wait.
You were right on track with the bison, definitely.
Oh, wait. I got a pork roast in the freezer. I'm going to do that with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, that should be great.
Yeah. You know why? Because barbecue sauce, usually the base is like sugar and molasses and like all of those same types of flavors. So the coffee syrup being the coffee and the cane sugar, and it's reduced down to the syrup and it has that caramely flavor,
right.
It goes perfect like that, yeah.
I'm getting a flashback of going on a press trip someplace. And it was where they make this absolutely great barbecued food.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a barbecue syrup with coffee in it.
Right,
and I
right.
never had heard that before.
Yeah.
Now I'll try to remember, like, you know, with all the traveling I do, it's like, where was I? What state in the United States? You know,
right.
things like that. Yeah, I definitely have a lot. Oh, you know what I thought about today? Oh, I'll tell you the other thing I tried it. I love experimenting. I mixed it with sour cream
uh-huh.
and then threw it in the freezer.
And?
Makes a great dessert.
Yeah, that's excellent.
But the sour cream offsets the sweetness, too.
Yep. Another great thing similar to that is Greek yogurt with coffee syrup in it.
Yes, what I was thinking about yesterday was when you buy plain yogurt, you know,
right.
and most, you know, this way you're getting something, there's no corn syrup, you're getting, you know, you're basically just flavoring it.
Right, exactly.
And
yep.
and you don't have to put that much in it.
You don't. Because it doesn't have all the bologna in it, it's like more concentrated of a flavor.
So you're getting the nutrition of the yogurt.
Exactly.
That's
and the nice
so
flavors
cool.
of the syrup.
Now do you have any have any other ideas of what Other than obviously, you know, like dessert kind of thing, What are the is any other savory things? Have you ever done it with chicken or fish, by the way?
Chicken, I have done it. Yep. And also, we made a glaze that we did on, aside from the pulled pork, we did pork chops, which was really good, and barbecued them instead of, when we did the pork, the pulled pork, obviously we did it in a crock pot. But
right.
The pork chops, we brushed it on and then grilled them, which was really good.
What else did you add besides, I mean, what else was in the barbecue sauce that you
used? I'll usually get, like, a good quality pre-made barbecue sauce.
Okay.
And I'll mix it with two parts of coffee syrup to one part barbecue sauce.
Oh, wow. So you really
On our website, we have a pretty extensive recipe to make the barbecue sauce by scratch.
Oh, good.
But a lot of times, you know, people don't have that kind of time. So what I'll do,
yeah,
like I said,
I got the time.
Yeah. Just a good quality, you know, barbecue sauce, and that ratio is delicious.
Then I see you have something like a cinnamon strudel coffee cake.
Yeah, yeah. In our coffee bar here, we bake with it a lot. We have a little kitchen in our coffee bar, and we're always doing different things using the coffee syrup. Last weekend, we did little chocolate cupcakes, and we poked them with a fork and then poured coffee syrup into them before they were frosted, so it kind of infused the chocolate with the coffee syrup. And then our baker made a buttercream coffee syrup frosting to put on top, and then a chocolate-covered espresso bean on top of it. They were delicious.
Oh, God. Wow. I was just thinking, like, I run a commercial on you probably never heard of Fairy Tale Brownies, have you?
I have not, no.
Well, I mean, it's really the best brownie you can find anywhere. Real,
uh-huh.
And they only, you can't, like, if you're on the West Coast, you can get them. Otherwise, you got to order it online. I mean,
okay.
it's almost like having fudge. And I'm thinking,
oh, wow.
These would really be decadent.
You're right.
Oh, my brain is going. And then there's this, wow, Grater's ice cream. That's like the best ice cream.
Yep.
Mm. Getting a Grater's ice, oh, just got it. Getting their vanilla chocolate chip ice cream with the Fairy Tale brownie and putting some of the coffee syrup on that.
That would be amazing.
Oh, man. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm getting a sugar shock just talking about just about doing this. So now, like, for instance, now you had said something about that you've tried it with chicken, like as a barbecue sauce, or
exactly,
you...
yep, in for grilling chicken, yep. So
okay.
We brush it on just like a barbecue sauce, and it's delicious.
And what about the seafood? Have you ever done it with seafood?
I have not. That could be something interesting, though. I do it with a lot of root vegetables. My big thing, like at Thanksgiving, used to be to caramelize carrots and then put maple syrup in it at the end, so it reduces down with them. But now, obviously, I use the coffee syrup, and that's delicious.
If Steve was just talking about one of the dishes that I had, that I definitely had wished it was a main course, but he did something with root vegetables. And when you said that, by the way, whenever you get a chance, you should slip and go to the restaurant and, you know, say, here's a sample.
Exactly. Which restaurant did you go to?
Hemingway's,
yeah. One of our favorite is Castle Hill in that group. It's an amazing restaurant.
Yeah, he might, that might be of interest. I love to connect people.
We did have a restaurant that was in Providence, Julian's, that did a coffee syrup creme brulee, which was delicious.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
My brain is... Wow.
And then there's the whole cocktail end of it, too, you know? That's what we were sampling when we had met in Providence at the Food and Wine Festival, that around... around the holidays, I don't know if you got to this little place called Farmstead, but it's a really great little cheese shop and restaurant in Providence. And they did a cocktail that had our coffee syrup, it had bourbon and eggnog and cinnamon, and it was delicious.
You know what that's, it's, you know what I'm thinking? That's kind of like when you're doing a cocktail,
mm-hmm.
instead of using Kahlua.
Exactly, yeah.
And a second liquor.
Mm-hmm.
That you just use the coffee syrup.
Right, right.
Have you ever tried doing like vodka with the coffee syrup and milk or cream?
Yes, yeah. There's actually another little place in Wakefield, which is a few towns over from Providence, and they did the coffee syrup with an organic vanilla vodka and then a splash of cream and a little Frangelico, which was delicious.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my God. yeah, that's good. I'm not a drinker. It's like I like tastes.
Yes,
it's like
yes.
That thing that you had.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't, you know, like, I would have to stay away because to me, I'm not drinking a drink, you know what I mean?
Right, right.
Yeah, you can really get, yeah, the word in Yiddish is shika. Yeah, on that.
Yep.
But it
is, like you had said about the Kahlua, it's a good alternative to do like almost like a virgin drink also, you know, because if you don't use Kahlua and you could do something creative with a little coffee syrup, a little half and half, some seltzer water, and a little cinnamon, you know, that would make a nice non-alcoholic drink.
Yes. Mm.
Yep. You know, I had somebody actually from Brooklyn that said that they use the coffee syrup in an egg cream.
As soon as you said Brooklyn, my
uh-huh.
brain went to egg cream.
Egg creams, yeah.
Yeah.
I've actually never had an egg cream, but...
You never had one?
No.
You know what it is?
I do. I mean, I know it's got chocolate and a beaten up egg and I think,
no.
what else, seltzer water?
No. There's no, there's no egg in an egg cream. Contrary to popular belief, there has never been an egg in an egg cream. The only reason why they had came an egg cream is because the foam,
uh-huh.
when the foam comes up, it looks like as if you probably whipped up whites of egg.
Okay, almost.
But
basically,
what you're doing is you're taking chocolate syrup, and it can't be any chocolate syrup. It has to be U-Bets, a company called U-Bets.
Uh huh.
Because this is it's kosher, but it also has been the one that everybody has used.
Right.
Because there's a particular, you know, whatever flavor or whatever. So you're
mm-hmm.
taking the syrup, and then you're mixing it with the milk, okay? And after you
yep.
mix it with the milk, then you're hopefully not just putting. If you put seltzer in like from a bottle, it's not as good as if like you're putting it from the soda fountain.
Okay, yeah.
But basically what's happening is as you put the seltzer in it, you're mixing it as you're putting
okay.
the seltzer in it. So,
the seltzer mixes it.
Yeah, so the seltzer,
yeah.
And what happens is the if you want to say it's like the cream from the milk comes up and on the top you're seeing what looks like, you know, that's why they call it an egg cream.
Okay.
So if you did the same thing, because sometimes people say, oh, would you want a vanilla egg cream?
Mm-hmm.
And use a vanilla syrup, but then now you can have a coffee egg cream.
Right, right, exactly.
So when you get the opportunity, try that. So, again, what you're doing is you're mixing the milk with the coffee syrup, not a lot of milk.
Uh-huh.
But you're mixing the milk with the coffee syrup. After
yeah.
you mix it, and then you're putting in the seltzer and taking a spoon and, like, mixing it really fast.
Okay. All right.
And that's
so
what produces that.
There's more seltzer than milk.
Yes. So we'll wise up. Yes.
Okay. Okay. I'll definitely try it.
So, yeah. Now I'll have to. Now I'll have to try it. That's great. Well, it's amazing how you can come up with some ideas. I'm going to experiment. I'm going to have.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to have fun with it.
And other things, like you were saying, just as simple as putting a little on ice cream is just so delicious, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So
have you ever put it on coffee ice cream? You don't want to do that, right?
I haven't, but what I did over the holidays is that one of the markets here had eggnog ice cream. And also, right around Thanksgiving, they had pumpkin ice cream, and both of those were delicious with the coffee syrup.
Really? Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, that wouldn't be my thing.
Uh-huh.
Of course, over chocolate ice cream, then you have mocha.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah.
A good chocolate ice cream or a good vanilla ice cream, I mean, those are perfect.
God, I'm getting hungry now. I'm waiting. I'm getting a package from Venda Ravioli today.
Yeah, from Federal Hill.
I'm waiting for the delivery of it, so I want to try the raviolis. I did a whole thing. We're going to do a whole thing on the hill and the food. We'll have to figure out how to get the coffee syrup up in there. Work that.
we're actually in one little bakery up there that uses our coffee syrup.
Oh,
but,
which one?
What is the name of it? She was on, it just went out of my head, but she was on the Food Network that had a cupcake challenge a few years back. And I want to see, like,
that's,
Patty's.
S-C-I-A-L-O?
Nope.
Sciallo Brothers? Okay, that was the one that I stopped in at.
Uh-huh.
Oh, but somebody, okay. Oh, but who knows? Maybe you can get that to this one.
Yeah, I got it here. It's City Girl Cupcake.
Oh, okay.
Yep, yeah. And they did some amazing things with the syrup.
Wow. And so mine is like racing with ideas. God. So, okay, so the coffees. Two coffees
mm-hmm.
that I got.
Yes.
Am I going to freak out? Because they're dark, what does that mean?
Well, it just means that as you roast a coffee, the bean contains all of the oils and the flavors inside the bean.
Right.
And as it's roasted, the beans get pulled to the surface. So typically, like a medium roasted coffee, we'll roast it for 12 to 14 minutes, and the oils don't come to the surface, and that's what you get, that kind of a chocolatey brown looking bean. But
right.
if you go a little longer to like 16, 17 minutes, you start to bring the oils out of the bean, and then you get that dark, almost like a French roast or an Italian roast look, where it's got the shininess on the bean. And,
uh-huh.
There are only, you know, there are some beans that are good dark roasted and other beans that aren't. And we only do one. The one I sent you is called Black Crow.
Right.
And it's a Sumatran bean. And that one is perfect to roast dark. It has a nice, bold body to it. And it doesn't have bitterness. It doesn't have any acidity to it. So it's just a roasty, bold. It's a great first thing in the morning cup of coffee.
Okay, and the other one was I don't have it in front of me.
I think we sent you the Blind Pig Espresso.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yep. And that's a blend that we came up with on our own, and it's our house espresso blend here, obviously, at our coffee bar, and has four different beans in it. Each one of them we've chosen for a different characteristic in the espresso.
So what I... Well, I now freak out. If I had a cup of that, and added some
coffee syrup to it?
Would that be like too much?
I think, you know what's funny? A darker roasted coffee like the
Black Crow. You know, I'm flipping out here with the thought. I'm flipping out with the thought. Yeah.
A darker roasted coffee like the Black Crow actually has less caffeine than a lighter roasted coffee.
Ah. Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember something about espresso has less caffeine.
Right, than a lighter roasted coffee. Yep, yep. So go for it. Do the Black Crow.
Okay.
Put some coffee syrup in it.
What's your website?
Dave'sCoffee.com.
Okay. All right. Well, I got you. Did you see the blog?
I did.
Okay.
It was awesome.
The chickens had a great time.
Yes, they looked like it.
Okay, Dave, it was great talking with you. And
you too, Merle.
When I write, I'll be writing some in the blogs as I experiment with them, too, with it, too. Okay?
Perfect. I look forward to seeing it.
Okay. Have a great evening.
You too, Merle. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes, I'm definitely having a, not a sugar shock. Now I'm having a coffee shock just thinking about it. But, heck, why not? Let's get, might as well get more into food, huh? Let's talk about a whole culinary arts museum. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Merrill. How you doing? I thought you might be talking about me there.
Oh, God. That was amazing. This, when you get some products, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having me on today to talk about the Culinary Arts Museum. As you know, there's nothing like it anywhere.
Well, let's start before we get into the history of it. This is part of Culinary Arts Institute, which is part
we're part of Johnson & Wales University's College of Culinary Arts.
Okay.
So we're on the Harborside campus in Providence,
mm-hmm.
and Johnson & Wales started out as a business school in 1914 with two ladies, one typewriter, and one student. And since then, it has gone very deeply into experiential education, and the culinary field is one of the things that we're really known for. So we have about 2,000 young people training to be chefs and to go into the food service industry within a stone's throw of our museum.
Now, just kind of like to get an idea, I'm sure it's completely different, but I've gone to, I did a one-day thing at the Culinary Institute up in...
Hyde Park?
New Hyde Park, yes.
Yes.
If you want to compare the two, and I realize that not in terms of how large, because with the one in... The one that I went to, you're also talking about restaurants as well.
Yes.
Whereas what I'm getting is that you don't, if you go to the, you know, go to yours,
mm-hmm.
You can't go out and dine there.
Well, not on campus, no. All the food service is run by students here, but they're for the students. But the university owns two hotels where they have restaurants. And so
I didn't know that.
Yeah, one is the Radisson Hotel, which is right opposite the TF Green Airport.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a restaurant there called Libations. And there's another one in Seekonk, Mass. Both of those are a little distant, though, unfortunately, from the campus. They're about 10 minutes away. But on campus, there are various kinds of dining facilities, and all the food there is made by the students.
So would you say in terms of, is it bigger than, like...
Our school is bigger than the Culinary Institute.
Okay.
And it offers different, I think it offers a more varied program, but they are quite interested in bringing the public in and running
restaurants right on campus, whereas our students go out and work, do externships and work in the field and get, a somewhat broader experience because they could be anywhere around the U.S. and they could be working for all kinds of different chefs with different cuisines and different MOs. So it's a little bit more of the real world.
Mm. So now, when did this museum start?
So the college here started in 1976, and not long after that, we received a donation from a collector of 7,500 cookbooks, which some of which went back to the 1600s.
Yeah, wait a minute. Did somebody go, oh, God, I got so many damn cookbooks. I need to
yes.
get rid of them.
And you know what that happens?
Oh, I know what I'll do.
Every day. The number of people that want to place, shall we say, their cookbook collections is tremendous. But this was an older gentleman who was really not connected with the food service business or industry, but he found us, and needless to say, this is 1979, this is before my time here, and he donated to the university when it was just a fledgling culinary school. And so the students here had these resources of old books, and they went into the library, and there was really not much interpretation of the history of the industry. And 10 years later, a chef and collector from Chicago donated 16 tractor trailer loads full of equipment, menus, books, gadgets, ephemera, and that was the real beginning of the museum. So,
and that you don't see all of that there.
Oh no, we have a fraction, a tiny fraction of our collection that's on display. Even though we have 25,000 square feet of gallery space here, where as you saw, we have everything from buildings inside our building to things as small as toothpicks.
Right. So, in other words, you're taking what you have in the warehouse, so to speak.
Yes.
And you're rotating.
Yes, we're taking some of these things and we're building exhibitions around them. For example, Chef Louis gave us, among other things, a collection of 600. Menus from airplanes, cruise ships, railroads, and roadside restaurants. And we did a show called Food on the Move, which is all about the different kinds of cuisines that one might get throughout history when you're traveling, whether you're in the air, on the rails, on the seas, or motoring along.
Right. I remember that exhibit, yeah.
Yeah, that's a fun exhibit. We have a tremendous neon sign there from Howard Johnson's from Reading, Pennsylvania. And that was a Simple Simon and the Pieman, which was their logo.
Uh-huh.
And that sign is about 60 years old. And that's a great example, actually, for food history people, because at one time there were more than 1,000 Howard Johnson's restaurants. They were the host of the highways. They were all over the place, but they almost completely faded away, all their restaurants, and now they're just a hospitality chain with the motels, hotels, and motor lodges.
Right. All right, so tell us about the thing with the diners.
Well, I was waiting for you to bring that up because I didn't want to plant any seeds in your head. But we do have the world's only permanent diner exhibition, and we have 4,000 square feet devoted to that classic American institution. We have a diner inside the museum that was built in 1926. It has 15 stools. And we trace the history of the diner, which really started out as the 19th century version of the food truck. I mean, it was a horse-drawn wagon right here in Providence, Rhode Island, and it came out and went to different businesses or operated at the prime spots where people could grab a bite and have a sandwich, a cup of coffee, a piece of pie, and a cigar, which was essentially the menu. And because of the success, it developed, evolved over the next 100 years into those classic stainless steel eateries that have dotted our landscape. But again, like Howard Johnson's, you know, are somewhat a thing of the past, but plenty have still hung on.
So, and one of them, I think, is being renovated. Is that what?
Yes. Well, we have one in the museum that last operated in Providence, and that was donated to us, and we've pretty much fixed that one up. We had an ice cream party here recently that was put on by one of the pastry chefs with his advanced frozen desserts class. And we have a soda fountain, and we have this diner area. But when we said that we could be serving in the diner, a couple of the students said, "I want to do that." And so they were behind the marble counter, and they were dishing up some champagne drinks with some or ginger ale for the youngsters, with some homemade sorbets and gelatos.
Oh, that's really cool.
It was great. It was great. We had more ice cream than you could shake a stick at.
I bet.
In fact, we invited a few families over here, and when I told the parents, as long as you don't mind your children eating nothing but ice cream for dinner, you should bring them along. And evidently, they're still talking about it 6 months later.
That is, was the ice cream made by students?
Yeah, the ice cream was made by students. We had a whole slew of different ice creams and toppings and sorbets and gelatos, and they made banana splits, and they had ice cream sandwiches and some bombs and some very fancy desserts, but it was tremendous.
So when these students are making, like, everything is from scratch then?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Wow, that must be cool to have that. I mean,
well, it's great, but I'll tell you something. It's also a hazard to one's waistline.
Yeah.
And people have said that I have put on a little bit of weight, and I don't deny it. But what can I say? I'm living the good life here as the director of the museum.
So, in other words, so you have events that are open to the public then?
We do. In fact, we're having a fun event on March 28th, if people are in the area, where we have a small exhibition of photographs called Lilliputian Landscapes. And the photographer is a woman from the North Shore of up north of Boston, and she creates these little landscapes made out of food, broccoli forests, or basically taking all different kinds of foods and vegetables and then places miniature people within them so that they're a whole lot of fun, and we will have an interesting reception based upon some of the foods that are in these photographs.
Uh-huh. In terms of for people to have the opportunity to, like, go to somewhere where they're tasting food.
We have some of them, but we don't have them that frequently.
Okay.
Unfortunately. But you can certainly see a lot of food in here and then go out to one of the nice little diners or cafes or wonderful restaurants in Providence, and you will have worked up an appetite.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure.
I think that when you see all the chocolate showpieces and the wedding cakes and the other things that are on display, it does want to send you salivating somewhere.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Chef Emeril was there?
Well, Emeril is a graduate of Johnson & Wales.
Uh-huh.
And we have a small gallery devoted to celebrity chefs and the business of of how it went from being basically a domestic or even a servant to becoming a professional. And so Emeril, as one of our most stellar grads, is represented by a nice life-size cardboard cutout. And people who visit the museum can snuggle right up to Emeril, and he won't be yelling anything in your ear.
Right.
Good photo op.
Also, there was another area for both children and rubber chickens.
Yes, well, we have a bunch of areas for kids, and we have a show called, an exhibition called Country Fair to Culinary Olympics, and that's about competitions, everything that you might see on TV, but we have some of the examples here, and it's in the Country Fair part. It's set up as if it was a midway, and there are some chickens in the livestock section. There's a small horse from Hasbro, which is one of our good neighbors here in Rhode Island, called Butterscotch. And you can, if you're of a certain size, you're allowed to jump on this horse and pretend as if you're galloping around or showing him at the fair. We have a skee ball machine as part of the midway, and that, of course, as a classic game of chance, a rigged game, I should say, from midways, that's very popular. But we also have
What do you mean rigged?
Well, it never quite gives you the exact number of points that you should get if you go in the hole. But it's authentic, you know. I mean, it's 60 years old, and it doesn't work that well. But it's
As a kid, that was the big thing.
Oh, yeah.
Skee ball.
Skee ball is very popular here, and it's so popular that our skee ball machine recently had to be admitted to the skee ball hospital for a checkup.
But you don't have to put money in then, huh?
You don't. No, that's the good part. That is the good part for the players.
Yeah.
I could have retired by now if we had charged a quarter, a nickel even,
for that.
The thing has been worn out. But in the other part of that exhibition, we have a wonderful video of the World Cup of Baking held in France from 2002, where one of our chefs was on Team USA, and they brought home the silver cup, and we have that cup on display and a nice little theater with 8 seats in it where people can sit down and watch this very nail-biting documentary, Who Will Win? And unfortunately, USA did not take home the gold, but the silver is nothing to sneeze at.
So that's the silver cup versus the bread that was called silver cup.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Yes. So that's a little glimpse of it. And then we have antiquities here, and we have things related to the presidents and some of their culinary habits, both good and bad. What else do we have? Oh, gosh, we actually do have a number of kitchen sinks here. You know, when you say everything but the kitchen sinks, we have several. In fact, we have more kitchen sinks than we could even put on display.
What do you have, what are you, wanting to bring out that's, stored right now?
Okay, well, one of my favorite things is we got a prototype machine from around 1930 or 31 that would automatically bake hot dog buns. And it has a hopper on the top where you would put the dough, and then it would be injected into these chrome forms that would make an unusual hot dog bun that supposedly wouldn't break apart and squirt mustard all over your necktie. And it would be advancing through a little oven, which was fired by gas, and then it would go through on these kind of tank treads, like a little motorized track. And then when they get baked, they come out the other end where these little doors open up and they get expelled, and they're ready to then be filled with a hot dog and gobbled down. But unfortunately, this machine never went into production, so we have the prototype along with some of the literature for it, and it was one of those better mouse traps that never saw the light of day.
Wow.
Very unusual item. And the person who designed it later went on to invent and make a fortune on the Bilco bulkhead basement door. That door that kind of every suburban home has, that's kind of leaning up against the basement where few steps.
Right.
And alas, he gave up his pursuit of the best hot dog bun for the basement access.
Right. Wow. Is there any other thing that you...
We've gotten a tremendous collection from a French chef named Roger Fessaguet, who came to the United States in 1949 from France, and he worked at the Le Pavillon French restaurant in Manhattan, and then he started his own restaurant called La Caravelle in Midtown. And this was the favorite restaurant of many luminaries at the time, including Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy. And Ambassador Kennedy asked Chef Roger to come to the White House and be JFK's chef after the election. But the chef had just opened Caravelle, and he said that he didn't want to work in a house. Didn't matter what house it was or what the color was. He wanted to be serving his loyal customers, and he recommended another Frenchman, René Verdon, who did go to the White House and became Kennedy's chef. And Roger gave us 47 boxes of material from his life in the culinary world, and that is some things that we have not fully cataloged, and we have not done the exhibition that tells his story. So that'll be great.
Wow.
Yeah.
So,
at one point, the New York Times Magazine called him the best chef in America.
Wow. So let's say if I went there, you know, having gone there,
yes,
if I come back, let's say, in a year,
mm-hmm,
will I see a lot of the same things and then...
Well, we are constantly changing things around, but we are doing a big inventory over the next year, and we will be focusing on that, and then when we come out of that, I think the greatest thing that we're going to have is we're planning on doing the 50 greatest undiscovered treasures that we found buried in the back, like the tomb of Tutankhamun.
Wow.
Hopefully we'll find some Egyptian relics.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be cool. Because you're going to be closed for a certain period of time.
Yeah,
right?
We are closed for a certain period. Yeah, we got the 16 tractor. We have a quarter of a million things. So if you can imagine the task at hand to deal with that and make them accessible, because if you don't know what you have, it's of no use.
Sure.
It can't be used. It can't be found. So I just found a little booklet the other day that says 50 ways to use marshmallows.
Oh, God.
Now, I don't know that many people who could eat 50 different marshmallow treats, but I think one night we're going to have a marshmallow night. And I wouldn't advise eating too many, but a little sampling of maybe four or five different things might be interesting.
Sure.
So that speaks of a certain era. Maybe we can have a Jell-O night, too.
Yeah. And there's always room for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when is the renovation period? From when
to
when?
The renovation, that's going to happen on May 20th, the day after graduation.
Okay.
So I would advise anyone who's listening to this terribly engaging broadcast who has the interest to get up here in the next 3 months. And then if you can't make it, you come back in September a year later and we'll knock your socks off.
Okay, so we're looking at from From the end of May.
From the end of May until
of this year.
Of this year until September.
September of next
2014.
Year.
2014. Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
That should be enough time, I guess, right?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. But the key is to not get too distracted by all of this wonderful stuff. I mean, some people would say, oh, 50 different marshmallow things? I'm going to take a day off and make all of them. And we're gonna put that off. We're going to keep ourselves under control.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yes.
Well, great. So, and what's the website?
The website is www.culinary.org.
Okay.
So check that out, and you'll see some photos of some of our exhibitions and some of our collections. And as we work on the back, we're going to be putting more and more things online, and you can visit us that way.
Great.
Great. Well, listen, I love being on.
Sure, I'm glad you. Yeah, this is it's always interesting of going to places that are not as common. You know what I mean?
Well, we're kind of one of those under the radar places, and we appreciate being able to chat with you and spread the word a little bit. And I'm glad that you came to see us last week.
Yeah, me too.
Great.
Well, have a absolutely wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too.
And give my regards to the food.
Will do.
Yeah.
Okay. Eat in moderation.
Yes, I'll try.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Ah, yes. Back to talking about food. Yes. All right. Time to, okay. What I want to do is I want to play a song. It's funny how I'm not realizing what I'm playing, you know, like as far as the music. What had happened, okay, so the sequence was I was watching the show Smash. I think it's Smash, right? And Jennifer Hudson is on it, and all of a sudden she was singing the song I Got Love. And I went, oh, I remember that song. That song from Pearly. I didn't even think of the fact that her character's name is Veronica Moore, as in Melba Moore, you know. And it's kind of coincidence, you know. And she definitely doesn't sound as good as Melba Moore, believe me. But anyway, so it started me thinking of trying to figure out if that was supposed to be. And then in the show, the character's mother is there. So I started looking at some things. And after I'm doing all this Googling and stuff, I realized I thought that I had seen the show Pearly. And now I'm looking through my playbills, and it wasn't the show Pearly that I saw, but a show called Innocent, not spelled, you know, innocent like we did. It was Innocent, I-N-A-C-E-N-T, Innocent Black. And she did this show in 1981, and it only went to 14 performances. And what I do remember, I remember seeing the show, and I don't know what she sang. I mean, she was holding the notes, and she's known for that. And I was, like, screaming and hooting and hollering, and I was kind of upset that the show, like, bombed, you know? But anyway, and I remembered all this. And as I'm, you know, doing my Googling there, I'm also finding that she was also in the Broadway show Hair, and I've been playing one of the songs on the radio all the time. But before I play that, I just want to say, I mean, now I wound up calling her manager because I'm trying to find out information. She's on the road. She's entertaining again, and she's going to be in New York on Long Island the middle of next month. So I can get the dates. I'm not sure. But also, even better than that, I'm having her as a guest on my show on March 28th. And we'll get some of the music, which I didn't download yet. I have it. But what I do want to play, just so I can hear it, is the Flesh Failures. And you'll probably, when you hear those hitting that high note, you'll know who she is.
We starve, look at one another, short of breath, walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smells from laboratories, facing a dying nation of moving paper fantasy, listening for the new total lies, with supreme visions of lonely tunes. Somewhere inside something there is a rush of greatness, who knows what stands in front of our lives. I fashion my future on film.
One of my favorite songs from the show. Now I'm going to have to find out some the others that have her in it, she played the part of Sheila. Now, let's see what else has come out lately. Emmy Rossum has a new album called, what's it called, Sentimental Journey? Journey, I don't have it in front of me. Anyway, so let me play one of her songs, Emmy Rossum. About things I used to do too, as a matter of fact. Yes. Hello. That's Esther Eunice. Okay. They were taking a nap, I think. They wanted me to comment on, make sure that I played Josh Groban's a song from his latest album. So let's play the song Brave.
Wake up, the sun cannot wait for long. Reach out before it fades away. You will find the warmth when you surrender. Smile into the fear and let it pass.
You wanna look away,
time just carries on. And all that she thought was wrong is pure again. You can hide forever from the
such a nice song, you know. But of course, okay, you know, my favorite of his. You Raise Me Up. Yeah, well, I'll play that another time. We don't want to hear too much. I am going to end the show right now. And I have, well, we're going to continue with Rhode Island, I believe. Let's see what's coming up on there. Oh, yeah, well, I want to talk about the zoo in Rhode Island and one of the other restaurants. And I have a list. Oh, yeah. And hopefully I can get Venda Ravioli to talk next week. We're going to chat with them. It's going to be a whole thing about authenticity of food that's supposed to be Italian. Is it Italian? Does it come from Italy? Just because the name is Italian doesn't mean, does it come from Italy at all? It's like, read those labels, and maybe, well, we'll see. We'll get the whole kit and caboodle. So, in the meantime, everybody, have a great day, evening, or whatever you're having here. Enjoy, and I'm going to have dinner.